Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast that's all about the rubles. Yes, I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir. How are you this evening, comrade?
I'm not doing bad, comrade. I apologize to Russia so much right now.
In Soviet Russia, apology gives you...
And on that note, yes, this is the podcast about film, where each and every episode we discuss a movie, and somehow it has to connect back to the film we discussed the preceding week. And Andrew, what were we discussing last time on this little program of ours?
Well, last week we were looking at Don Siegel's 1971 film, The Beguiled, which featured one Geraldine Page, who is our point of entry into this week's film. Which, honestly, had David not recommended it, I probably wouldn't have even known of its existence. We're looking at White Nights, Taylor Hackford's 1985 Cold War ballet film, starring Mikhail Baryshnikov, Gregory Hines, Helen Mirren, and Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah, so, how on earth do we combine ballet and the Cold War? Well, we're glad you asked, folks. But I guess to sort of start off this conversation, we need to kind of back up and give a little bit of context for this movie. Now, I think, Andrew, given our previous episodes of the show, we've covered the Cold War fairly in depth.
Well, seeing as every single episode we end up making jokes about Ward Bond, yeah, I think it's well-worn territory. Even when we're not trying to. The Red Scare always pops up somehow.
Yeah, so, super short version, basically, Western nations, Soviet Union, didn't quite get along on a political or ideological level, and for about 40 years of heightened tensions that never quite broke out into open conflict, they basically kept their distance from one another.
Yeah, sounds nice and concise.
Yeah, kind of avoids the proxy war side of things as well, but we'll actually get there a bit tonight, but yeah, so that's the key thing here. Now, one of the things that we've also briefly touched upon in the show when we did their Hunt for Red October episode is the concept of defecting and leaving one's nation and basically betraying them to join another nation for one of any number of reasons. Maybe it's ideological differences. Maybe it is political differences.
Maybe the food's just better.
It could be in many things here. But the thing about it is, in the abstract sense in a film like that, that is kind of a, big deal. But, I mean, you don't really get the full embodied experience of that in a pulp thriller of that sort. Certainly, it doesn't help that in that film we have characters who conveniently seem to have no ties left to their homeland.
Yeah, I was going to say, Marco Ramius, it's just, okay, well, he's going to do this, and that's pretty much all there is to it. I think it's also worth mentioning that, especially for audiences of today, I'm not going to pretend that the world is a uniform, happy place where people can travel freely wherever they go. Sovereignty and sovereign association is still very much a real issue, but it has a different level of import in the 1980s, and actually all throughout the Cold War. The idea of going to Russia and saying, I want to become a citizen of your nation, that has a very different political sort of resonance that comes with it, because it's not just I'm choosing to live somewhere else, but in Cold War terms, it's I'm choosing to subscribe to a completely different ideology and way of life. I am choosing to turn my back on my country and accept this other one. Not saying that that's true, but that's certainly how a lot of people perceived high-profile defections.
And there were many over the years. But for our purposes, there is one real-life defection that really is significant in terms of the film we're discussing. And that is of this film's star, Mikhail Baryshnikov, who in the early to mid-1970s defected from the Soviet Union during a tour of Canada, basically seeking political asylum there, and eventually establishing himself as a significant ballet dancer in North America, initially in Canada and then moving into the U.S. And Baryshnikov is, I'm not sure how many people know him these days, but I'll put it to you like this. Baryshnikov, even as a kid, that was a name I recognized, even if I could not place why I knew it or why it was significant.
Well, I know why, because Susan Sarandon mentions him on The Simpsons.
That is also a thing.
That was my introduction. But, yeah, and I mean, like, Baryshnikov, his defection is also important because, like, I remember a couple years ago learning that the CIA actually sponsored the work of abstract expressionist artists in America, like Barnett Newman and Mark Rothko. And they promoted abstract expressionism because it was in such stark contrast to, like, the rigid formalism of Soviet-approved art. Because you got to remember that under the Soviet Union, everything is directed by the central party apparatus. And yes, I know I'm reducing everything, but we're not here to talk about geopolitics. We're trying to talk about a movie here, so that'll do. The point is that Baryshnikov, part of why he wanted to defect as well, is that touring internationally, he became exposed to all sorts of different styles of modern and contemporary dance, not just limited to ballet. And in his native Russia, there was no audience for that, and there was no infrastructure designed to produce that. So, in a very real sense, I mean, art was a major consideration in his defection.
Yeah, and the thing with Baryshnikov is, once he defected, not only, first of all, he'd already established himself very famously by this point, at the time of his defection, which made him a rather significant figure when he chose to defect. It drew a great deal of attention. And from that point forward, he basically went on to continue being, hands down, what was generally considered the best ballet dancer in the world. Now, I have to sort of put an asterisk beside this for a second, not because of that statement, but because this is information I myself have gleaned from what I have read about Baryshnikov, and has in no way, shape, or form bears any relationship to my actual knowledge of ballet in the ballet world.
Well, my understanding is that Baryshnikov, you know, there were certainly contemporaneous male ballet stars back in the Soviet Union, some of whom ended up touring internationally. Baryshnikov, like, his talent coupled with the high-profile defection, he was certainly, like, I think if you polled audiences in 1985, or even now, name a male ballerina, I'm pretty sure Baryshnikov is the name that they're going to mention. I mean, I don't think his contemporaries ever ended up getting a season-long stint on Sex and the City, so there you go.
Well, yeah, and that's the key. You know, for our purposes, this is all you really need to know, was that, yes, he was a high-profile defector, major ballet talent, and certainly there had been efforts to get him to expand his career beyond the ballet and into film. And he had made some dabbles into acting in cinema prior to this, but one of the things he had turned down repeatedly was offers to actually film the story of his defection. For one reason or another, certainly I can't find too many details as to why he decided not to do that. But eventually you come to the mid-80s, and we have to turn our attention to a completely different figure, and that is of filmmaker Taylor Hackford. Now, I'll put it to you this way, Andrew. I'm assuming you are, to at least some degree, familiar with Hackford's work, if nothing else.
Yeah, I think, like, his output has certainly decreased, and he was never one of those directors that, you know, you could put his name on a marquee and people would go see a film because of that. But, I mean, certainly films like Ray, which ended up winning Best Picture, whether or not people associate him with that film, that was certainly a high-profile film. He also did The Devil's Advocate, did he not?
I think that may have actually, yeah, it was him. I honestly can't remember offhand, but yeah, that one was a rather notorious late 90s film for those of you who weren't around at that time.
Hoo-ah!
And in the early 1980s, as he's sort of initially establishing himself, probably the biggest film of his career up to this point had been An Officer and a Gentleman, an Academy Award-winning film that I think has not dated well by all accounts. It has been a long time since I've seen it personally, and I'm not necessarily all that eager to revisit it, but the point of the matter is, Hackford had a great deal of clout coming off that movie, and he also had a particular interest in wanting to make a film about dance. And his initial approach to this was deciding that maybe what he wanted to work with was one of the most talented tap dancers at the time, and that was one Gregory Hines. Now, Hines is an actor who, at this point in time, has been dead for quite some time. He passed away relatively young.
Way to frame this one on a positive, Dave.
Yeah. The key thing about Gregory Hines was, though, was that, yeah, he was what many considered the triple threat actor. He could sing, he could dance, and he could act. And tap dance was something he made significant. He was very well known for. I mean, he was a great improvisational dancer. He had unmistakable talent. And I don't know if he ever really could say he became a megastar in film, but he ended up developing a decent body of work and certainly would go on, if I'm not mistaken, to become a acting and dancing instructor himself as they went on into the 90s.
Yeah, and tap is one of those things where I think it's always going to be pretty marginal in North American culture, and even this film kind of speaks to the fact that tap is something with limited appeal, but for somebody that got their start by being a tap dancer, I mean, Gregory Hines probably is the most successful of his kind and of his generation. I know that, like, doing some background reading on him, apparently Sammy Davis Jr. was his hero, and largely because a figure like Sammy Davis Jr. wasn't just an actor, wasn't just a comedian. It's sort of like that classical throwback to the song and dance man, in a way. He's an entertainer.
Exactly. And, you know, for Hackford, that was kind of his way in. Now, he sort of took this idea originally to Orion Pictures and tried to develop there, where he was given the recommendation of, well, what if it was about two great dancers? You had Gregory Hine, probably the most famous tap dancer there may ever have been and ever probably will be. And then you had the possibility of Mikhail Baryshnikov. And this film really stems from that. Not from the idea of having a story to tell with them, but just the notion of, let's get these two individuals on the camera, on film together. And Hackford, by his from his admission, then started seeking out a story that would justify having these two individuals in the same film at the same time, which, you know, turning to James Goldman, a very noteworthy screenwriter behind films such as The Lion in Winter and Robin and Marion, which are not insignificant works of the 1970s. What they end up coming up with is basically a political Cold War thriller, which wouldn't necessarily sound like the sort of thing that you would do with, you know, two of the world's biggest dancers now.
That is not even remotely what I thought this film was going to be. Because, you know, generally, I like to come into a film pretty fresh, because some of the most satisfying experiences, like, when I saw Drive in theater, I had no idea what it was about or the kind of movie it was supposed to be. And every single time I formed an expectation, they were subverted, and it was delightful. Sometimes that works out in your favor. Sometimes it ends up being catastrophic. In this case, though, I will admit that I was kind of imagining Baryshnikov as, like, a talented upper-class dancer in America, Gregory Hines as maybe, like, a street-level guy on the up, and they have to come together to foil some criminal conspiracy or rescue a kidnapped woman through dance. This is not that film.
Yeah, no. What the story that Goldman cooks up and eventually writes with rewrites seemingly done by Eric Hughes, who wrote Hackford's earlier film Against All Odds, and with some supposed script work done by Nancy Dowd of Slapshot fame. That one, I honestly can't speak to whether she actually did or did not work on the film. Regardless, the film White Knights is ultimately about a character, Nikolai Rodchenko, played by Baryshnikov, who, much like the real-life Baryshnikov, is a famed ballet dancer who defected from the Soviet Union 8 years prior and is seeking to, and is, you know, at the top of his fame, at the top of his popularity, and is about to head to Japan to go on a tour over there. Slight problem, though. In the process of the flight, the plane suffers a mechanical malfunction and ends up having to crash land in Siberia. This is, of course, right within Soviet territory, and Rodchenko naturally kind of panics about the possibility of being taken in by the Soviet, back to within the Soviet government, and, you know, basically being punished for his earlier defection.
Yeah, the Russian bear has a long memory. And, yeah, so he's grounded there, like, quite literally. And moreover, he's injured in the crash because while everyone's safely strapped in, he's running around like a lunatic, shredding his passport and trying to flush it down the airplane toilet. And then he ends up getting injured, which gives the Russian government the pretext to separate him from the rest, claim that he's being held for medical care, when de facto he's really just been imprisoned.
Yeah, and at this point in time, a Colonel Chaiko, played here by noted Polish filmmaker Jerzy Skolimowski, I've probably botched the pronunciation of that, forgive me, folks.
That stands to me, Jerzy Skolimowski.
Yeah, he is basically, in this film, the face of the Soviet government. And he cooks up this plan to not only hold Rodchenko back, but basically engineer a situation in which he will miraculously reappear, having chosen to quote-unquote return to the Soviet Union and dance once again for the Russian people. In order to try and pull off this plan, however, he needs to convince Rodchenko to agree to it and agree to make this appearance. And while certainly there's, you know, he uses many strong arm tactics, his key to this is an individual by the name of Raymond Greenwood, played by Gregory Hines.
Now, Raymond Greenwood, that's a strange name for a Russian.
Well, who Raymond Greenwood is not a Russian. He is a black American who defected to the Soviet Union basically due to his experiences in Vietnam, having, you know, become sort of despondent over the fact that, yeah, he was being asked to commit horrendous crimes on behalf of that, not to mention the bigotry back home, and the fact that, yeah, there was really no place for him to be able to develop his talent as a tap dancer to make money at it. And the Soviet Union basically offered him the promise of not only not having to fight in a war like Vietnam, but, you know, the possibility to make his way up in the world, which...
Well, when we're introduced to him, it's him performing Porgy and Bess in Siberia, so that gives you an idea of how well that worked out for him. But yeah, the shorthand version, though, I mean, yeah. Raymond is basically Edward Snowden, and Baryshnikov is basically Baryshnikov.
Yeah, and what ends up happening is Chaiko basically pushes Raymond into acting as more or less Rodchenko's babysitter and attempting to convince him to agree to participate once again in the Russian ballet. And as part of this, what he's basically offering Raymond is for both him and his wife, who is played by Isabella Rossellini, to be able to make their way back to Moscow and presumably, you know, work at a much higher level with a much greater salary at their disposal, and therefore make their way in the world. So this leads, of course, to the tension as Rodchenko moves in with them, and we start to see the two men basically clashing over their respective forms of defection and ideologies as to how they perceive their home nations.
Yeah, they're a slightly more self-righteous odd couple. But, because, I mean, not only do they have very different life experience, American-Russian, white and black, someone who defected to the States versus someone who defected to Russia, and even just their own style of a more classical ballet in Baryshnikov and the very American and sort of rhythmic art form of tap dancing with Gregory Hines. And yet, it turns out, they both have something in common. They both love dancing. And ultimately, yeah. America.
Yeah. So basically, the film, as they bond over time, as Raymond sort of begins to chafe against the restrictions and pressures being put on him by Chaiko, and eventually realizing that his wife, yes, is pregnant, and as Rodchenko keeps seeking ways to try and get out of the Soviet Union safely and return to his life in the Western nations, basically, yeah, the film becomes a thriller as they try to plan their escape, with side material going on with Sorry, Geraldine Page as Anne Wyatt, Rodchenko's manager, who's constantly spending time at the American consulate trying to create, get them to investigate the situation and hopefully find a way to get Rodchenko out.
Yeah, because that's definitely a complicating factor to the narrative and sort of crucial in making it plausible. Because the issue is, during the height of the Cold War, an American plane ends up going down, and the Russians have allowed the people on board to seek shelter and take care at a Russian military base. And the film makes a big to-do of the fact that Russia's riding a great wave of PR, and so it's not gonna do anybody any favors if Geraldine Page starts accusing them of kidnapping an American citizen. So there's definitely, like, through that angle, there's definitely more political commentary, in the sense that it's not just the superficial, like, oh, I miss my life in America where people were truly free. It's one of those elements in this film that kind of complicates what you would think would be a very superficial dynamic. Because, you know, even though it just pays lip service to it, the film does acknowledge, like, well, when you're looking at things in terms of international diplomacy, it's a little bit more complicated than let the good guys do the good things.
Yeah, and this is the thing about White Nights. And broadly speaking, this is a film that is honestly much smarter than you would actually expect it to be.
There's a lot going on narratively, I'll give it that.
Yeah, while still not necessarily being as satisfying and incisive as I think the filmmakers believe they're being as well. Because, yeah, there is a ton going on here. This is a film which is simultaneously hypercritical of the Soviet Union, which, again, big shocker given that this is a film produced by America in the mid-80s. But it isn't, you know, letting America off the hook or pretending that it is completely this a perfect land compared to what the Soviets are coming up for. There is some legitimate material in this film, but yeah, Push criticizes the U.S. for its policy decisions and, you know, the bigotry that exists throughout the country.
Yeah, it's definitely on the far side of Red Dawn or something like that. It's a film that ultimately is celebratory of America, but it doesn't come off as propagandist or overly jingoistic, I would say. Like, it's kind of like that mature love, where it's, okay, there are things about you that drive me crazy, and I really wish were different, but I still love you deep down.
Yeah, at the same time, this is also a film where our Soviet villains of the piece, namely Chaco, are just this side of James Bond villains.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a movie where we get to see Chaco in, you know, basically workout gear, boxing his way to rock music while watching people on a CCTV.
That was probably my favorite cutaway in the entire film. It's because I'm like, I want to live in this man's life for one day.
Exactly. So, I mean, it is an uneven movie, and it's not a terribly complex movie, but on the whole, I gotta say, I really kind of enjoyed this one, which is maybe more than this film got critically back in 1985, because this did not get the best reception then. Hackford at least claims that, in large part, it's because it was a film that irritated both the left and right-wing critics at the time.
I don't think people who are terribly politically invested were going to be flocking to see theaters to go see White Nights.
Well, that's the thing. And what criticism you can still find from the era, namely Roger Ebert's review, mainly comes down to, hey, you got a thriller in my dance movie. Well, you got a dance movie in my thriller.
This movie's too thrilling to be about dancing. There's too much dancing for it to be thrilling.
Precisely.
And then a fist fight breaks out in the parking lot. Well, I mean, to give this film some points, though, it did more than make its money back at the box office, and it does have an Academy Award win to its name.
Yeah, for Lionel Richie's song, Say You, Say Me. More on that in a bit.
Hang on, folks. This is going to be one of those films with a lot of little things that we have to talk about. But maybe we should begin at the beginning. How does this film open, Dave?
Well, it opens up with basically a classic ballet performance from Baryshnikov, which it takes a little while to reveal that, yes, this is happening on a stage in front of an audience. But basically, yeah, it is a straight up about like 8 minute long sequence of getting to see Baryshnikov do his thing and demonstrate that, yeah, this man is a hyper talented dancer there. And it's one of those things where, I admit, again, I'm sure if you are, you know, a ballet fan and you know your stuff, you're probably going to get more out of it than I personally did, because, again, I'm not going to lay claim to being familiar with the work that it's interpreting at the start here. But, you know, it does lay the groundwork very effectively for understanding what kind of skill this man has and the world he exists in, basically, of high art and high society.
Yeah, and, like, ballet as sort of, like, the highest of high art through antiquity in that. That also immediately frames Nikolai as a person with a certain position. And as we come to learn later on in the film, that also carries a certain kind of blindness. Certain sort of lack of awareness of his own privilege as well. But I mean, honestly, David, considering that I thought this movie was going to be a dancing buddy cop film on the Lower East Side of New York, I spent the first maybe 5 minutes until the curtain came up in the background just staring slack-jawed, thinking, what is happening? But yeah, I mean, though, it opens by really foregrounding not just, like, the ornate mise-en-scene of the theater or what's being done on stage, as much as, like, Baryshnikov's body is clearly the focus of this sequence. And, yeah. I mean, contrast that to Flashdance, where we were talking about how with dance films in particular, there is typically, and like historically, there's very much an emphasis on shooting in long take, shooting in long shot. So you're letting shots run, taking as few takes as possible, and showing the whole body in the frame in order to emphasize like the athleticism and the physicality on display. And the interesting thing about Baryshnikov is that apparently he's only 5'6". And when he was first starting out, people thought he would never make it. But you realize, like, the way that he moves and the way that the camera chooses to, like, what it emphasizes in close-up is, like, there's a certain grace and elegance about him that I think certainly 1985 audiences might be tempted to consider effeminate. But you also look at the moves he's doing and the sheer amount of physical strength and composure that it requires. It's pretty stunning, even if you don't have, like, a deep historical appreciation of ballet. And it makes me wonder, like, because there are stories about Gene Kelly and, like, maybe not as much Fred Astaire, but the idea that Gene Kelly was one of those guys that really wanted to show audiences with his work that dancing is not a woman's field, that it's possible to be, like, a strong, virile, masculine man while still being an incredible dancer at the same time. And I feel like, without ever making it explicit, I feel like the film is making some attempt to do the same thing.
Well, it definitely, I mean, this is a film that positions Baryshnikov as heroic, certainly. And it doesn't, you know, tiptoe around the fact that, yeah, much of his desires is built around dance. Like, there is nothing where they try and deflect it or justify it or anything. It's just who he is in this film. And kudos to them for that approach. And I would agree with you. That opening sequence, like, there's a moment where he is able to maintain his legs in the air on, like, just the flimsiest part of his back. And just maintain that posture for some time. I would have collapsed before even getting to that point, without even remotely.
I mean, chest pains from answering the telephone.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the thing. I mean, you know, this is, you know, a film that very much foregrounds that, yeah, he is, I guess to come back to him, a very physical specimen. And yeah, again, we should note that this is an entire sequence where, yeah, he's performing this pretty much shirtless the entire time. So yeah, his full body is almost complete, or his body is almost completely on display as the scene's going on. And yeah, it's very much inviting the audience to look upon it throughout it. So again, yeah, I mean, he is... It's a very subtle thing, but the film is sort of highlighting the fact that, yeah, there is something I don't want to say prized about him, but certainly in that notion as to why you kind of very clearly understand why the Russians would want him back despite his previous actions, or why he would be a coup to get.
Yeah, he's almost like an exotic bird in a sense, where, yeah, we're invited very much to look upon him, and there's a certain exoticism about him and the way that his body is framed. But at the same time, I think in doing so, it tries to subvert, like, the idea that, oh, dancing, that's for wusses, and instead it's like, yeah, you want to see what a real man can do? Look upon this, ye mighty, and despair. But yeah, so it's, I think it's just bridging the idea that, well, dancing isn't just, you know, it's not just limited to putting on a tutu. Like, not saying that this film was intended to, like, kick off a new dance craze to sweep America, but I think in the way that it chooses to position its characters, and certainly, certainly once Raymond is introduced into the film, I think on some level there's also that attempt to be like, look, males in the audience, there are different ways you can dance, and none of them involve leotards.
Well, absolutely, and I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, it's also interesting how the film sort of highlights the physical toll right at the get-go of doing this kind of performance is, because as soon as the sequence is done, we get an amusing shot of Baryshnikov basically dunking his feet into an ice bucket to try and basically deal with the pain in his feet from having performed the physical feats that he's just done. It's also interesting, apparently before each dance sequence in this film, Baryshnikov had something, either a physical therapist or masseuse work on him for about 3 hours prior to each sequence, because of the toll it was taking on his body to do the work he was doing for this film. So,
well, some of the lifts that he does in this movie, I could certainly believe it.
Yeah. So, but yeah. So, I mean, the film very clearly sets up Rodchenko's situation very early on in the film, and this leads us to the plane sequence, which, again, you know, in a dance movie, is actually a pretty spectacular bit of stunts and special effects together, and rather tense little film. And again, apparently, it did involve the production paying $70,000 to buy a 707 jet, repaint it, and then deliberately smash it to pieces.
See, I'm just amazed that you can buy a 737 for only $70,000. So that's all the more reason that we start our own Patreon in the new year.
Yes, we need our own private plane, folks.
Yeah, just to see if it can be done. But yeah, like, this sequence honestly feels like it's coming out of a different movie. Like, it's more in line with Die Hard 2 than anything. But yeah, the plane goes down, and there is that tension, because they know the runway is too short, and just the rapid editing of the plane's descent, and the stress on the pilots' faces, and even once they land, the Soviet trucks at the end of the runway, it's like, oh no, brake! And they're like, oh, I'm sure we can! And then all of a sudden, the plane blows through everything and shears off its wings.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing we didn't want to happen.
Yeah, and from here, I mean, I guess one thing which we haven't explained yet, I mean, the title. It's probably good to explain, what on earth does White Knights actually mean? Because the film goes out of its way to explain it at the around this point as well, which is basically the notion that given the position Siberia and Russia have to the Arctic Circle, this is a period of time where basically it's all day daylight, more or less, or at least a very thin version of what night would be, where it's you're still getting that sort of twilight light going on at the time.
It's prolonged areas of sun exposure. I don't know how long it runs. Apparently it's a phenomenon. Though they bring it up on the plane shortly before it has an electrical malfunction and goes down. And keep in mind, at this point, I still have no idea what this movie is going to end up being about. So at first I'm like, so wait, did the Leningrad White Knights cause the plane to go down? Like, have the Soviets found a way to weaponize sunlight? It was like, actually, no, just sheer happenstance.
Yeah, no, I honestly think the intent of the idea of White Knights is more about that, a sort of quasi-symbolic reference to the notion of sustained duress and paranoia from the situation they find themselves in.
Okay, remind me to come back to that by the time we talk about the ending, though, because I think that film, by calling the film White Knights, it also invites a very problematic reading.
Fair enough.
But we'll get there.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I mean, we spend the first half hour or so of the film getting well acquainted with Nikolai, up until he discovers the situation, and, you know, from that first meeting with Chaiko, like, it becomes clear that, well, nope, they know exactly who he is, and they are not letting him go anytime soon. And then we're introduced to Raymond. And so, yeah. I guess by contrast, obviously there's the immediate differences between the two, but how are we introduced to Raymond?
Well, as you acknowledged earlier, basically we see Raymond performing a section from Porgy and Bess on stage. And the key difference here, it's like a very small local theater that they're performing at as part of this traveling show. And the thing, again, much like the earlier sequence which introduces Rodchenko, basically what we very clearly recognize is a couple points about Raymond. Number one, he is exceptionally talented at what he does, and this sort of energetic dance style that he has. And yeah, he is a born showman, and he eats up the feedback he gets. Because yeah, it's a small little dinky theater that he finds himself in, but he works the room like nobody's business, dancing right off the stage into the aisles, entertaining the people, and again, just putting on this sheer physical display in front of them. And again, as shot by Hafford, again, there are he's very clever in how he shoots this, because you're right, much like with the stuff with Bershnikov at the start, he does allow the camera to hang back and focus in on him throughout, but there are very selective close-ups, including in the case of Gregory Hines, there are some close-ups specifically onto his feet.
Yeah, see, I was worried from the get-go that we were going to have another Jennifer Beal situation where they're doing that to mask.
Yeah.
Because in that first dance sequence, there are a number of close-ups. But then you realize when it pulls away, nope, that's Gregory Hines. We're closing up on his feet because no human being's toes should be able to move that fast.
Exactly. And it gives you just a great sense of his skill at that. And it also establishes a few things very clearly about the Raymond character as well, because one of the things is his showmanship certainly seems to rub his co-star the wrong way. Certainly in the idea of him being a quote-unquote American big shot there. But we also discover that, you know, he gets along, you know, he seems to be happily married, generally seems to be happy. There's just something very awkward about the fact that here he is performing this great big famed New York show in the midst of Siberia.
Yeah, so you know something went wrong somewhere. But, I mean, I do like that sequence a lot, especially in contrast to that opening, because, again, not only do we see different styles, but, like, at first I was almost like, Hines dancing struck me as a little unspectacular because it doesn't have the same pageantry of that opening theater sequence. But then you realize, like, he's using his body as an instrument, like a rhythmic instrument. And sort of realizing that and just his coordination and the way that, like, his own physical expressiveness informs that dance. I know that there are much more technical and accurate ways to talk about, but here we are. But also, I think there's something significant that he's performing Gershwin, specifically a song about going to New York, and also, like, just hopping off the stage and dancing through the crowd. Like, that is also a marked contrast to the sort of the detachment that comes with theatrical exhibition in a ballet setting.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, there is that, again, that remarkable distance between, you know, the paying patrons of the ballet and that sort of, you know, critical distance there where, you know, you look upon but you do not touch versus Hines, who's deliberately interacting with the crowd and getting them on their feet.
Yeah. And I guess, join in, like, dwelling on that kind of makes sense because that first impression we're given of both characters pretty much stays accurate and stays constant for the rest of the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's very economical in how it's establishing character and very much how it's servicing, you know, both theme and plot in both instances. And I think at these points, Hackford is really on his game as a director in terms of the choices they're making, in terms of his staging, in terms of the selection as to what kind of, you know, what kinds of performance he's showcasing in his film. It's very deliberate and very considered. And certainly his heart seems to be in the right place here. But then again, of course, this is all surrounded by the Chaco stuff as well, where, again, that just this side of a Bond villain, where, yeah, he wanders in and basically, you know, subtly, not so subtly suggests that, you know, well, your situation could be better.
Yeah, he strongly recommends.
Yeah, what he needs to do to sort of help him out there. And of course, I mean, watching Chaco throughout these scenes, you know, he's always coming up with, when Raymond starts, oh, well, I tried to get in contact with you. It's like, oh, I've been so busy. And it's, you know, it's clear he's lying through his teeth. He doesn't even have to bother lying well in these situations because he is the man holding all the cards.
Yeah, it's you call his bluff. You know, and there are a couple scenes where I think Chaco's most effective by having those sort of open implication statements, especially when they go visit the mine and he has that little aside where, you know, when Raymond's expressing doubt whether he'll be able to convince Nick to end up going along with the plan and dancing for the Kirov Ballet, how they sort of look upon all the workers toiling in the mine, and Chaco just reflects, he's like, yes, that's no way to live. Surely it must be better to be a part of the theater, no? And just shoots him a look, and then they just move on. It's, I like scenes like that, probably because it's the few times where Chaco gets to show restraint.
Yeah, yes. But this leads, yes, inevitably to ultimately Rodchenko showing, just waking up magically in Raymond's apartment, his wife's apartment.
Daria.
Daria, thank you, yes. Their apartment. And, you know, putting aside, how did he get there without knowing? Which we'll choose just to overlook that right for now. It becomes very clear right off the bat that, you know, Raymond is going to try and hard sell him on the notion of, well, hey, you're here. It's okay. You should be kind of grateful that, you know, that you're back in here. I mean, there are all sorts of opportunities for you. And Rodchenko is not having any of it, leading to sort of a, not quite a chase scene through this little small Siberian town as he tries to track down a phone where he can just make a call without being spied upon by Raymond.
Yeah, because Raymond basically tells him when Nick wants to go outside, he's like, yeah, you're free to go. And then, sure enough, Nick ends up bolting. Then Raymond chases after him, which does lead to the very amusing line when Nick finds the phone, he's trying to call out and let someone know he's alive and being held captive. Hines runs in after him, out of breath, and saying, I really don't like when people make long-distance calls without permission.
Yes. I also love how completely abandoned this town seems to be. For a minute there, it's like, so wait, are they, like, the only three people here? Is this, like, some sort of weird monitoring situation? Like, it took me a minute to realize, it's like, no, I guess this is supposed, that's right, this is the middle of the night.
Are they on the same island that The Prisoner was filmed? I don't know. Maybe.
But that's a sequel.
Okay, one thing that I am curious about.
Yes.
I don't feel like it's entirely clear what exactly happened to Raymond after defecting, because there is some dialogue that definitely implies things like when Daria notices Chaco coming by, you know, Raymond is trying to make the best of him and be like, well, we need to hear him out. Like, he could help us. And she remarks, I think he's helped us enough already. But am I mistaken, or does the film not really go into any detail beyond that?
The film doesn't go into immense detail. What is implied? Well, I guess before we even go down that road, brings us to the key scene for the Raymond character, where he has him, Daria, and Nikolai have a drunken, in Raymond's case, a drunken conversation, which leads to Gregory Hines delivering this drunken tap dancing monologue about why he defected.
Now, this is where the film really turned a corner for me personally, because this is the first insight, like, oh, So it's not just going to be every other movie about the Cold War.
Yeah, because it is hands down probably the best scene in this movie. And Hines delivers, where he basically explains his whole history of growing up, you know, in as a poor black man in America, the racism he experienced, and how, you know, he had all this skill that, again, was going to waste in America because nobody pays or respects tap. And
especially once you get older and you stop being cute.
Yeah, and for him, what ends up happening is he all of a sudden describes, well, you know, coming outright and saying he's a Vietnam soldier. It's very strongly clear that, you know, he gets drafted, and he thinks this is a good situation because, hey, he can, you know, as he puts it, sign up to become a communications expert and learn a real trade that he can make a living at. And instead, much like many Vietnam vets, was basically sent over there to kill and maim anyone and everyone.
And I think there's a strong implication because this is the first scene where race comes up. And I think, you know, I think it's very important that if you're doing any kind of like comparison between America and the Soviet Union, like that analysis becomes complicated when you're looking at it through a racial lens. And, like, it's initially signaled when Nick is talking about how much he misses being back in America. And I think what prompts it is Raymond drunkenly observing. It's like, oh, you miss America, eh? You miss going through Manhattan and L.A.? Well, when's the last time you walked through Harlem? What about that part of America? And I think there's the strong implication that, like, as well, being a soldier, like, he wanted to get in the technical sector. They said that they had other plans for me. And it strongly implies, like, well, yeah, because, you know, in Vietnam, the idea of black officers working in a technical capacity, that wasn't something that was done. And then he realizes it's not just that they were sending me out to go kill. They were sending me and my brothers out to die.
Yeah. And yeah. And at this point, you start to see, again, Hines just delivering as he breaks down.
Yeah.
At the trauma of all of it and basically explaining it. Yeah. You know, I was given the opportunity to defect because there had to be something better than that in his existence. And I can't remember if it comes up at this point or if it's a little bit later on. You know, we then start to see the implications of what this had on his home life because, yeah, he has a father who basically considers him dead to the world, a brother who won't speak to him, and he wasn't even able to get through on a phone call to talk to his mother as she died. And these are the things that he gave up in order to come over there. And there are clearly some regrets there, but the film goes to great pains to give a damn good justification for why this guy did what he did.
And I think Hines's emotiveness in this scene, even though I'm kind of two minds about, like, I think that's crucial because objectively to be like, well, I'm a black man in post-Vietnam America. My country doesn't care about me. Like, I think it's a bit of a hard sell to look around the world and be like, well, Russia, they're going to treat me with respect. They're going to be a happy patron of my artistic craft here. And I mean, like, there are some sort of like cute little back and forths with Raymond and Nick early on where he's explaining like, well, I wanted to come here because, you know, audiences in America don't appreciate my art. And then Nick just gives him that sly little smile and he's like, oh, and you found an appreciative audience in Siberia, did you? Like, the thing is, like, without conveying, like, that sense of betrayal and that sense of anger at your own country, it's not very plausible that you would think Russia would somehow improve the situation. But the way that Hines carries himself through that monologue, you at least get that sense of desperate frustration why it would seem like a good idea, even though it's patently clear that since defecting, absolutely nothing has worked out the way he has wanted it to.
Well, the thing about it is, and again, I think one of the nice touches, it's strongly implied that the Russians sort of wined and dined and held him up as, you know, see, here's the prime example of somebody who saw the benefits of coming to Soviet life. And probably for the first little while, you know, it was great for Raymond, and they probably were giving him a bit more respect over time. And then it was his propaganda value fell, they just shoved him to the side, which again, and a nice echo of, as you acknowledged, the statement about, you know, what happens when you cease being a cute child who can tap dance. What happens to you? Well, your use suddenly becomes very limited.
Well, yeah, he's gone from being a tool for American interests to being a tool for Soviet interests.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, the film really, when it comes to the stuff with Raymond and his situation, I think it really, the attention to detail that Hackford and company pay to it is crucial, and it pays off in the long run for the majority of this film. Because so even when it gets somewhat ridiculous, we're getting there, folks, you still have that emotional investment in the long run for how things are going. And it certainly helps that he's playing off of Isabella Rossellini here, who, as I sort of acknowledge in our notes, she does not get a lot to do in this movie. This is
this is one of her first film roles, is it not?
It's her first English language film, which is why she gets the introducing credit.
Yeah.
But she'd done, I think, a few Italian films prior to this, but that was it. And, you know, again, I'm not going to speak to the quality of her Russian accent because I honestly can't tell necessarily.
She has a weird tonality to her voice, in any role. She has one of those voices where she could be from anywhere, and I think that's part of the charm. I'll freely admit, Isabella Rossellini is one of my favorite actresses, so it was nice seeing her and realizing, yeah, here you sound convincingly Russian, just as you sound convincingly Italian and convincingly American every other movie you're in.
Yeah. And she, again, she doesn't get much to do, but she has a really charming chemistry with Gregory Hines in this film, where you kind of understand how, yeah, this is a couple that works. This is a couple that respects one another, and you can completely buy why they're together throughout this film, and why, you know, why Raymond would make decisions that he does over the course of it. I wish she had a bit more to do ultimately at the end of the day, but again, kudos there, because I mean, without her, I think there would be a lopsidedness to this film and a hole there that it does not have thanks to her presence.
Well, yeah, and I guess she's sort of mirrored, I suppose, by Helen Mirren's character of Galina, who, when we're introduced to her, we discover that she was Nick's lover prior to his defection, and when he left the Soviet Union, he left her behind as well. And she apparently has risen up in the party apparatus. She's now an official of some renown. And yeah, so she ends up reintroduced to his life, and suddenly Nick has something that he needs to reckon with.
Yeah, and the thing is, the film, so yeah, before she's even introduced, in one of the sequences that doesn't quite work, the film, you know, Nick finally agrees to go to, is it Moscow or Leningrad?
Leningrad.
It is Leningrad. Okay, that, with Raymond and Daria there to at least seemingly go along with the plan that's at play there. And this leads to this introduction to Leningrad sequence that, man, I don't think it was intended to be as funny as it is, but when you cut to the shot of the statue of Lenin and then cut out with the dead serious music rapidly, dun, 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 out of it, it is, this is where the somewhat cartoonish side of the film really starts to come into focus in terms of how the Soviet Union is portrayed at points.
Yeah, it's one of those moments where I'm like, I'm not totally sure what they were going for, but I'm pretty sure that whatever they had in mind, they didn't achieve.
Yeah, not at that scene. And certainly at this point, yeah, we come back to, and Nick discovers that his old apartment has been left like it was 8 years ago when he left. And I love the notion that apparently they've just been keeping this apartment just in case
this situation. I mean, whatever. I'm just like, where are the enormous piles of dust?
Yeah, I mean, clearly a cleaning crew's been through here. But yeah, basically Nick comes back and he's now expected to train to get ready to be part of the opening night of the ballet here. And this lead, before he's reintroduced to Helen Mirren's Ivanova here, this leads to basically the first of the sort of Raymond and Rodchenko basically hate bonding over dance for lack of a better description, where, yeah, we get the gloriously ridiculous sequence of Raymond and Rodchenko gambling over the number of pirouettes he can do.
Yeah, because it starts very much as a game of one-upmanship. And yeah. Raymond is thrilled because somehow Nick has a boombox with cassettes, no less.
Yeah.
So remember, everybody, there was one point in time where this was a luxury item. And sure enough, like, what begins as, like, much more confrontational, like, we can already see there begins to be that thaw and that camaraderie between the two men.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, as I was saying, it leads to this ridiculous moment where, basically, he challenges Rodchenko convinces Raymond to bet 11 rubles on the possibility of him doing 11 pirouettes.
Yeah, by God, he does it.
He does it, gets the ruble, puts a ruble in his mouth, and then, as you quite notably explain in our notes, Andrew, bumping and grinding I think it's the Lou Reed, My Love Is Chemical song.
Late 80s point. Lou Reed, which, I mean, as a longtime Velvet Underground fan, is the worst music on earth. That's the like moment the when Helen Mirren walks in.
Putting aside my defense of that song, because, yeah, I kind of dug it. But, yeah, this is the point where Rodchenko and Ivanova finally meet up again. And you start to see some of the old tensions sort of flare up in the sense of, well, he took off basically without telling her that he was defecting. And, understandably, she's kind of ticked about that. And again, in one of the details, the film, I think it is quite nice about the film, is it does dive into the notion of, is defection a heroic act or a selfish act? And the film never really settles on a particular answer in this instance, other than, you know, it's an act with consequences.
Exactly. There's always people that you leave behind, and sort of, whatever your reasons, the film basically says there's a moral duty in looking those same people you leave behind in the eye and at least telling them why.
Yeah. And basically, yeah, following this sort of confrontation, we get the, again, one of Nick's immediate efforts to try and find a way to contact the American embassy. And
though, if I can backpedal for a second.
Sure.
What I like about that scene, though, is that I can see many other films where it's like, oh, you left for America and you left me here. And it's like, well, it's the land of freedom. Instead, Nick doubles down on being petty and defensive about it, where he basically plays it off like, oh, well, you seem to be doing more than fine for yourself. I hear you're driving a Mercedes. And I love it because Helen Mirren, she just looks at him and says, oh, what? And what do you drive in America? A horse? And, you know, it. I like that this film is willing to be critical of its protagonist and star, and at least push back on the idea that he's our hero, so he can do no wrong. Like, the film does, not in a deep and sustained way, but it's at least willing to entertain some criticism about him.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the thing. I mean, Nick is, I mean, you understand where he comes from, but yeah, that doesn't suddenly make him an innately noble individual. He's, yeah, kind of a petty, selfish jerk, for lack of a better word.
Well, yeah, his stardom affords him some privileges that many other people are disconnected from. And whether, like, Raymond and,
Daria?
Russian names. No, Galina. Raymond and Galina, like, they're both criticizing him for the same thing, but from very different angles. And I think that's pretty clever and certainly not an insight I figured that this film would have any interest in giving.
Yeah. And, I mean, yeah, again, kudos to where, I mean, again, as long as the film's focused on the character stuff, I think it's in really, really safe hands, and it's really pulling off what it wants to. Then you get, you know, it's just then, again, you cut back to some of the thriller stuff, and some of it works, some of it doesn't. This does lead to a scene where, following her, this confrontation that doesn't end particularly well for either Nick or Ivanova, she leaves, he says he's going to take a long shower, and we get to see a intercut sequence of a frustrated Raymond just tap dancing, improv style, to a tune, while Rodchenko is rushing along the rooftops of Leningrad, eventually arrives at an old ballet studio that he presumably trained at, and interrupts a class of young ballet dancing girls, asking him to deliver a message there, and comes to discover that, yeah, he's basically been... he's been scrubbed from the Russian collective memory, more or less. There, he's been, his prominence and fame has basically been marginalized and pushed to the curbed.
Well, yeah. I mean, what's the point in celebrating this guy? He was a traitor to the nation in the eyes of the party. So instead, yeah, he ends up being chased away by a bunch of young girls who are brandishing weapons. So, I mean, like, and eventually, though, like, this leads to him... he eventually, because I'm trying to wrap it up, there's a lot going on in this movie. Eventually, yeah, like, he sort of makes good with Galina again. They at least come to some understanding. And turns out that she happens to be at a high-profile party dinner where one of their guests of honor happens to be somebody from the American consulate. And I know it's somebody David was thrilled to see in this movie.
God bless John Glover for being in this movie. He gets to show up as in the wonderfully named American character, Wynn Scott, who, yeah, he isn't entirely sure whether she's winding him up or whether this is just a Soviet ploy. Ends up, you know, finally working out with the ambassador, I guess, or in Russia, and with Rodchenko's agent, you know, sort of begins to put together this master plan where basically they will sneak him onto the American, into the American consulate at a party full of guests from countries that are not exactly America's friends.
Yeah, they indicate that it's the leaders of the Third World. And yeah, that seems like an odd line to throw in, but then they explain, yep, these are all nations that receive no aid or funding from America, nations that are not favored ally status, so they'd have no reason to lie about what they saw. Because the real concern that is expressed in the consulate scenes, they're like, yeah, but right now Russia, again, they're riding really high on good PR, they keep pointing out. And that they're worried that, all right, well, Nick's gone missing. All of a sudden, his ex-girlfriend, who happens to work for the government, is saying, don't worry, we have him alive and we need you to rescue him. Their concern is that they're being set up to look stupid in an international incident.
Exactly. So the film basically from this point forward sort of rushes headlong with Rodchenko, you know, making his preparations to find a way to escape. And as Raymond comes to realize that Daria is pregnant, deciding that he needs to get out of Russia because things are, you know, he recognizes that this situation is all smoke and mirrors. It's not going to improve for him. If anything, it's only going to get worse. Particularly after a very brief window of time when Daria is taken away by Chenko because of Rodchenko having managed to escape to that ballet studio to fail to deliver a message at. So.
Yeah, and then once they're reunited, though, the turning point, I guess, narratively, like, from the outset, Nick wants to get out. And even though, yeah, Raymond, you can tell he's not happy there, like, he is very much a pragmatist where it's like, I'm going to try and make the best life for me and my wife. Once he's reunited with Daria, though, he finds out that Daria's pregnant. And that's what motivates him not only to help Nick, but to try and get them out of the country, too.
Yeah, and from this point forward, the film basically follows along with them creating this not exactly all that believable scheme to trick their overseers and enable them to escape. And this is probably some of the clunkiest stuff in the film, where, number one, again, Mikhail Baryshnikov and Gregory Hines, I think, both give legitimately good to great performances throughout this film. But whenever they're asked to do their overly confrontational being jerks to one another to throw off the scent of their overlords, it's a bit much and kind of obvious, yeah, to say the least.
I mean, it's one of those things where, like, diegetically it kind of gets a pass because you know these guys are performing. But at the same time, I don't see how you can be the head of the Soviet secret police and hear Mikhail Baryshnikov be like, I do not like your dancing. You are such swine. And be like, ooh, these guys are really getting into it. It's exactly. Like, the same way, though, that, like, in the earlier scenes where Raymond is trying to secretly convince Nick to dance for the Kirov Ballet, where it goes from, well, you gotta stick around here for a little while until you're better. You know, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. You should probably dance for the ballet. And yeah. He seems dumbfounded that Nick is suspicious of his intent. You know, it's one of those areas where these men are fabulous dancers, and I think their performances are certainly adequate, but their subterfuge in trying to convince Chico that they're not getting along and they're a second away from tearing each other's throats out, that fails to convince. And, I mean, if there's any point where you kind of see that these are not necessarily professional actors in the same way that, say, a De Niro is, these are the moments where it becomes most clear. It's just a shame that these are the moments that the climax is built upon.
Yeah, like, the height of the film, like, the sequence I think the film builds to and is probably, were it not for Hines' confessional monologue, would be the absolute best scene of the film, is the dance duet to Prove Me Wrong by David, is it Puck or Pack? David Pack, yeah. Where you see Rodchenko and Raymond dancing more or less, not in perfect unison. You can see there's the points where both men are somewhat uncomfortable with each other's style. But again, narratively, it kind of works. I mean, thematically, it's right on point. The idea that these guys are more or less now in lockstep with one another and making a way through. And along with it being a actually really great song to dance, too. Again, it is a memorably done sequence. It's well shot. It's energetic.
And like,
as
it's shot in a way where those points where they're not in perfect sync, like, stylistically, yeah, that also goes to really underscore, like, the individual component of dancing. Like, they're both doing the same steps, but they're doing it in their own way. And, I mean, that also happens at this moment of, like, the respect between the two is solidified. So once again, like, whether or not that's deliberate, like, it forms an interesting synchronicity between narrative, theme, and visual style that, again, it's a lot more clever than I thought this film was going to be.
Yeah, the problem is, then we still have another, 15-20 minutes of them escaping the apartment via, or at least Rodchenko and Daria escaping the apartment while Raymond decides to stay behind and in more dubious play acting on his part, trying to give them enough time by distracting Chaco by complaining to him and drinking his vodka.
Because Chaco shows up. Their escape plan involves making a rope out of bed sheets and then shimmying across an alleyway to a ladder and then running to the consulate. So,
and not forgetting the boombox as well, with the recording of them arguing.
yes, of course. That. Oh, why did you keep auto rewind on, foolish Raymond? It's a very, given the narrative import of what would happen if they were to be caught, like, the scene isn't all that visually interesting, and there isn't really much of a sense of tension. And maybe that's just because me as a viewer, like, the same way when I saw Argo, like, there was no suspense to it, because I'm like, well, I know enough about the historical story to know that they get out of the country okay. And, I mean, that's not necessarily a failing of the film, but here it's just like, okay, well, we're watching people shimmy 6 feet in the air to go down a ladder. This feels very low stakes and non-kinetic, given the fact that this is a film predicated on dancing.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, again, most of the climax then becomes a low-speed chase where a cabbie who, if I'm not mistaken, is played by William Hootkins of Batman.
Yes, it is. friends of the show and fans of 24 panels per second, listen to our Batman episode. We have a good old laugh about William Hootkins.
Yes, but yeah, he's driving a cab with John Glover in the front seat, and it basically leads to this low impact collision where the drama hangs upon Rodchenko and Daria walking past Chaco. Yes.
Meanwhile, as everyone in the consulate gates, their whole suspicion is, well, I don't know if it's if that's them. We'll wait until they move closer so we can be sure. And I'm like, what is happening?
I mean, it's one of those things where I see what they're trying to do. The staging of it, though, is so poor that it doesn't really work at all.
Yeah, it's a damp squib. And, like, I think that's just the weirdest thing about this film, because for a film that, from its outset, is predicated upon dancing, starring two of the most visible male dancers in the world at that point in time, you know, you would assume that it somehow culminates in a dance sequence. And, like, I was imagining that either, you know, he has his performance at the ballet and that's when he makes his escape.
Yeah.
Or they escape to America and then it ends with him dancing at the ballet, but then Raymond comes out and then they do a duo piece or something on stage. Like, I feel like that would tie up all the threads very neatly. Instead, we get our dance segment for an audience of no one, and then the movie just sort of ends at its own speed aside from that?
Well, it's one of these things where the ending of the film, from this point on, there's one last sequence, which is basically months later on, where Raymond, having spent time in Russian prison, ultimately he thinks he's being taken out to be executed by Chaco. Turns out, no, it's a prisoner exchange for a Soviet I guess war hero, spy, whatever.
Yeah, like a high-profile Russian national who is in State Department custody. So they do the prisoner swap, and then, like, it's kind of clever with the use of spotlights and fog, so it's not immediately clear. And eventually, Raymond realizes that, no, he's being returned to U.S. custody. Nick and Daria are there to greet him. You know, and then everyone reconciles, and then it ends on that weird freeze frame of Baryshnikov and Hines' faces maybe a foot apart from each other as they look longingly at one another. And then it dissolves to the credits, and we get Lionel Richie's Say You, Say Me. And I'm like, I feel like they had to freeze that shot because I was convinced they were going to kiss.
Well, this is the thing. There are a whole many weird details about this because...
Oh, yeah.
Because let's put it this way. First of all, why is Rodchenko and Daria there? I'm not entirely sure if they really bring loved ones to prisoner exchanges all that often. I'm going to assume for security purposes that's not generally the way things go. Two, for Gregory Hines, having been in a Russian prison for quite some time, he's been remarkably decent shape in terms of his facial shaving and hair.
Okay, thank you. Because Chaiko actually says, like, oh, you're looking thin. I guess Russian prison do that to you, or something to that effect. And I'm like, he looks exactly the same, just a little sadder.
Well, yeah, but I mean, on top of which, there are two more critical details in this ending sequence that are even more problematic. The less problematic one, but still worth noting, is, again, I was kind of assuming that Daria would be there with their baby. You know, you would kind of assume like, this would be the thing. I see no child even remotely here. She doesn't look pregnant at this point, so... You know, did they just... I mean, again, I understand not bringing the child to the scene, but if you're going out of the way to bring her to the situation, a civilian, I mean, you might as well have brought the kid anyway.
Well, they're letting him idle in the back seat. They brought a Game Boy. He'll be fine.
But two, and this is the thing, and I think it speaks to your point about, you know, what the climax you would think to this movie would be, which is, here's the problem with this whole situation. As the film makes explicitly clear, if Raymond returns to America, he is going to be in prison because he is a defector. He was a soldier who defected from America to come over. Why is there a prisoner exchange to get him out in the first place?
Well, yeah, because even when he makes the decision to leave, like he says to Daria, like, whatever comes next, we have to try to get back to America. So he knows, like, his return to America is not going to be completely free of problems. But, like, I think the bigger issue I have with the ending is that, okay, Raymond, Raymond is a very sympathetic character because he goes from being dispossessed in America to being dispossessed in Russia to, like, having monologues about his own hopelessness and the feeling of uselessness, how he's just this instrument that is used by different governments and different people and then discarded. And even during the transfer, Chaiko is acknowledging, he's like, you are of no value to us, but we're able to trade you for this guy, so I guess you're finally good for something. And, like, the film never has that redemptive moment where Raymond is self-actualized or there's anything happy about it. Like, he's basically kicked around, and then at the ending, he's still being kicked around to go to an uncertain and unpleasant fate, but because him and Baryshnikov smile at each other, everything's okay?
Well, this is the thing. I think the way Hackford and company would view it, him sacrificing himself to stay behind would be that moment of self-actualization. The idea of making a choice that knowingly puts himself in jeopardy to save others. Putting aside the complicated factors of the fact that this is a situation in which a black man is sacrificing his own life and security for his wife.
For the real hero of the film.
Yeah, and the white Russian who, you know, defected years earlier. I mean, it's one of those things where I see what they're trying to do, but it's almost the film has to end at that freeze frame, because if it goes any further, then the movie has to go on for at least another 30 minutes to deal with the complexities of his return.
Yeah, and then we get Serial Season 2 as a film.
Well, something like that, or at least I was almost half expecting there'd be a situation where, like, you know, an admittance where Rodchenko says, you know, I've been staging this press thing to get your plight recognized in the public eye and explain what happened and what went on. But of course he can't do that because, as Chaiko sort of explained to him, it's like, you have to keep your mouth shut about this going forward, because remember, I've got him. So even he wouldn't be able to do this. So, I mean,
yeah.
I just...
Oh, man, that's right.
Like, and that's the thing, it's like, I don't understand. It's a tacked-on happy ending because ultimately they looked at it, it's like, well, you can't leave Gregory Hines in a Russian prison to die. And...
yeah. You can't live G Hines B Hines.
Well, it's the thing. It's
as
like
the kids say.
No kid has ever said that. But the thing about it is, yeah, I mean, the honest version of this movie would be that, yeah, probably Raymond does die in a Russian cell. I mean, you know, I'm almost surprised that he wasn't shot and killed previously in the film. Yeah, and that they wouldn't have been a situation where, you know, the ending of the film is, you know, like Rodchenko checking in on Daria in America and promising, you know, in like show, you know, like 5 years later and showing this kid how to do a little bit of tap dancing to sort of help encourage, you know, here, this is what your father taught me. I'm passing it up on to you. Something like that is where I...
Well, what about this? Like when they're running to the consulate, like Raymond pops out of an alleyway, causes Chaiko's car to drive off the road and crash into a silo full of manure, and then everybody gets to the consulate, and then it has, like, the title card underneath everyone's face, where it's like, Nick returned to New York and became top ballerina. It's like, you know, Raymond went on to marry Daria and become a radio repairman. And, you know, something like that. And then William Hootkins, his whereabouts are currently unknown. You know, like, just double down on it. If you're going to have a happy ending that's tacked on, make it a really happy one. Don't just have people smiling in pitch black night, surrounded by fog and barbed wire in a Soviet prison camp.
But it has Lionel Richie on the soundtrack. How can you not be happy with that final shot? Like, seriously,
well,
I still can't...
close your eyes. Yeah, I don't know. The same way that this is the song that the film won an Oscar for, and it does not appear diegetically, like, within the film until
it
the
also,
film is over.
It also doesn't appear on the actual soundtrack either if you want to purchase it. Even to this day,
It's...
it's on iTunes. It's still not on the soundtrack this many years later. It's impressive.
But I think, like, just the ending and the way that certain things aren't resolved and the fact that the sacrifice falls on Raymond to make, I mean, that's just why I think calling this film White Knights is a little unfortunate, because in a way it almost is a Freudian slip. The same way that it's like, okay, well, we're having this story about recognizing difference and interrogating your own freedom, recognizing how good you have it and that others in your country may not. But at the end of the day, we all know who we're really here to cheer for. And it kind of rubs me wrong, especially because this is a film that makes gestures to be critical and split that difference, and then by the end, it loses all interest in doing that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's halfway to being an honest and dedicated, you know, politically minded thriller, and then it has to cop out in order to be as Hollywood as can be. And it's unfortunate because, you know, I think with a little bit more polish and effort, this could have probably been an even better movie than it is.
I think it could be a lot better movie than it is, but I suppose that's what we have our bumper segments for.
Well, yes, and I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say don't check out White Nights, because it's a fun watch, if nothing else. Like, and for all the film's problems, and they're there, unmistakably, I had fun watching this movie. I mean, there was never a point where I was sitting there, oh god, I really regret this choice for this particular podcast. I mean, it's a fun film. It's got a great soundtrack. You know, mm-hmm. Me and Andrew disagreeing on Lou Reed, aside from things, Chaka Khan is on there as well, so...
And don't forget Phil Collins.
And Phil, yes, the love theme. Phil Collins and Marilyn Martin, which is Separate Worlds, which was all... Or Separate Lives, not Separate Worlds. Sorry, I'm thinking of the Journey song.
Yeah, that's the one he wrote after he watched that guy drown. yeah, he God co-wrote it with the dude's myths. Wife. Sorry, widow. Okay, let me put it this way. There is a sure. difference between a film that is bad versus a film that isn't very good. This is a film that I think we can agree does have some clear flaws. I would say it's too long by at least half an hour. There are some structural issues that we've talked about and do not resolve. There are many more that we haven't had a chance to talk about. I think some of the performances are very uneven. I think the film forgets what it's doing well three quarters of the way through it. And yet, there's something that I can't really come down on the film too hard about. And I think it's because there is a sense of absolute earnestness from frame one to the final frame about this movie that it's very peculiar. I think it's purely at the level of affect and difficult to explain, but like at no point was I ever convinced that everybody on screen like wasn't totally 100% genuinely invested in what they were doing. I think Baryshnikov, despite his limitations as an actor, and even Hines, despite like probably carrying the bigger emotional moments, he does have limitations as an actor too. I think it's a messy hodgepodge of ideas that by all accounts shouldn't work and ends up working better than it has any right to. I think it still has a lot of flaws that prevent it from being a quote-unquote good movie, but there is something very singular about it. And I know that I am never going to see another film quite like White Nights, but there's also something refreshing in the earnestness on display. That everybody, they all believe in what they're doing. There's never that moment where somebody rolls their eyes or like gives that little wink to the camera of, I know, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. There's something refreshing about the total lack of cynicism in this movie.
Well, yeah, no, that's the thing. I mean, you cannot, like, nobody went into this thing, you know, half-assing it or, you know, like, this is slumming it. Or in the case of Baryshnikov, it's like, look, I just need a paycheck to fund what I'm really doing over here. And, I mean, you know, it's an honest effort from everybody involved. And yeah, I mean, it's a crowd pleaser at the end of the day, you know, for better or worse, there. And it's unapologetic in being that. And that's fine. I mean, there's probably, yeah, the darker version of this and more politically poignant one that we could have. But for the film we've got, I mean, it's not that bad. The dance numbers that are on screen are genuinely great.
Yeah, they range from good to incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, you know, there's enough there to make it a decent rental, if nothing else. I mean, you know, I don't think it's going to, again, it's not going to be suddenly like one of the lost classics of the 1980s that we've all forgotten. But I mean, you know what? It's a film that doesn't deserve to be forgotten per se. I mean, it's definitely, you know, a showcase for a very particular group of talented individuals at a very particular moment in their respective careers. That
requiring a very specific historical and political moment for any of it to be sensible.
Exactly. And I honestly don't know whether... I honestly couldn't imagine trying to remake this film in this day and age, because I have no idea even who... on a level of comparable talent to Hines and Baryshnikov, who you would substitute into this film for it to work. I don't think they exist.
Well, they could do anything with CGI these days. I mean, Darren Aronofsky convinced us that Natalie Portman could dance.
Fair enough.
And act. Hoyo.
Oh, boy. Clearly, we're now getting sidetracked there. So, yeah, this is a film. It's reasonably easy to get a hold of. It's available for rental. It's on DVD. Don't think there's a Blu-ray of it yet. I'd imagine one of these days somebody will release it. But if you want to track it down, by all means, it's there. You should be able to get your hands on it. So,
yeah, and if permanent sunlight has made it difficult for you to sleep and you have 2 hours and 20 minutes of your time to fill, there are worse films you can watch than this. We have watched worse films for our podcast. You know, this isn't among them. It's not quite bonkers, and it's not garbage, and it's not a masterpiece. It's sort of on the upper echelon of like, okay. You're never going to see another movie quite like it.
Yeah. So, with that, I guess we should turn our attention to the Hits and Pits segment of this program. And, Andrew, I was the one who subjected you to this film here. So, I'm going to let you take the first stab at a hit for this movie.
Okay. Well, I mean, honestly, I know I probably sounded very negative on it, but there are a lot of little things that I do like about the movie. I think in terms of overall, the most important thing that I would like to point out, and you did mention it earlier, is the dance choreography, and of course my phone closed where I have my notes in there. Yeah. David, do you remember the name of the choreographer?
I think it's Twyla Thorpe, or Thorpe?
Twyla Thorpe, yes.
Yeah,
Thorpe. Who I'm not terribly familiar with their work outside of this film, but... it's interesting what's on display, because there are the scenes like the opening where we get more of a sort of pure classical approach to ballet than certainly with Hines' scenes, which I understand he choreographed himself. He has the amazing credit of tap improvographer in the credits.
I think that's only in reference to his freestyle dance scene by himself. I think the other ones were choreographed by Thorpe.
I'd imagine so.
Yeah.
Because by that, by the final dance number, the duet, like, you actually see that fusion of styles where they mutually inform one another. And, like, yeah. It's just, regardless of what's happening in terms of cinematography, like, the dancing is incredible enough that, like, it holds your attention. I am not a patron of the theater, but honestly, like, it is hard to come away from this film without having a sense of reverence for both men's abilities. And considering that they have very different styles, they have very different approaches, and they even contort their bodies in very different ways, there's still a sense of vitality and kineticism about it. This is a movie that made me interested in ballet, okay? So that deserves a hit right there. What about you, David? What do you have up first?
Speaking of cinematography from your statement there, I'm going to give David Watkin, the cinematographer on this film, quite a bit of credit, because, yeah, up until the final shot of this, or final scene of this movie, this is a film that, you know, is shot completely, is supposed to be set ostensibly during endless daylight, for the most part, which, you know... okay, you say that out loud, and it's like, well, big deal. But given that this is a film where you have to sort of suggest the illusion of changes in terms of time and day throughout, you know, he makes the most of it and does a great deal of work to sort of create an eeriness where appropriate. There's one shot really early on in the film that I think is great where you see Chaco in a sort of Jeep driving out of a hangar full of the airplane passengers. there, and there's this sudden shift where you're going from the darkness of the interior to the exterior in the exact same shot, where suddenly bright light is filtering through the entire scene. And, you know, again, the sort of shock of that. I mean, again, Watkin really captures that quite well. Hackford does actually make humorous note, though, that he was not a camera operator whatsoever on the film, though. Apparently, his approach to working on this movie was to light sets and scenes and then go take a nap and let everybody else do their job. So the fact that it turns out remarkably well with that kind of work schedule, kudos to you. You have to know your craft in order to make that work.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it takes a certain amount of heavy lifting to make a Soviet-era construction look visually dynamic, so...
Yeah, so, but what's another hit for you, Andrew?
Here, it's honestly a challenge to narrow down to one. I also don't want to step on your toes, because I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to do, so... I'm going to give special mention to Mikhail Baryshnikov, because, make no mistake, this film really is his movie. It's asymmetrical in its screen time and in its focus, but, and like, okay, we talk about Baryshnikov being an amateur actor, but it's also important to remember that in 1978, he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Turning Point,
yeah.
But his appearances in film are pretty sporadic. This is a weird role, because so much of it is... kind of cribbed from his real life, even the idea of, like, when Shaikov, like, tells him, ah, the Kirov Ballet, all these other people dance there, and so did you, and he points to Mikhail Baryshnikov, who first became famous dancing for that same ballet. But, like,
yeah,
Baryshnikov doesn't give a perfect performance. There are moments where he's awkward, and his delivery is stilted, and he's saddled with dialogue that sounds very inorganic, but he is so charming,
like, yeah.
That he gets a pass for me, where there's, again, speaking to that earnestness, like, even though he speaks in broken English, it's not an obstacle to understanding him, but, like, he'll disarm him and give him a smile, especially those scenes with Raymond. It's very difficult not to like him, even in scenes where he's supposed to be a jerk. You can definitely understand Baryshnikov's appeal and why Hollywood producers saw him as, this is the guy that's going to make ballet a household, well, name, I guess. I think he carries himself well, like, certainly in the dance scenes, like, he is magnificent. And the scenes around that, like, he doesn't drag the film down at all. Considering that he's the central figure in this film's narrative, he carries himself well pretty much for almost everything that he's asked to do. And that was pleasant to see. It means that if I want to see his acting chops, I don't have to watch Sex and the City. So kudos to you, Comrade Mikhail. What about you, David?
I'm going to double down and really give Gregory Hines.
I knew it.
Just a second. Yeah, because Hines really... You know, I'm not kidding when I say he gets the heavy lifting in this movie, because you're right. Baryshnikov is, you know, very charming. And he's, again, I give credit to Baryshnikov as well, because he is willing to allow himself to be a goofball on screen as well. He's not afraid to look dopey when the film requires it. Like the aforementioned bumping and grinding scene earlier in this episode, where he's deliberately looking foolish for the camera. Hines, though, I mean, Hines, he really, if he was not in this movie, it would not work even a fraction as well without it. I mean, he has to carry the most of the major dramatic material in the film. His dancing numbers are, again, just as difficult as whatever Baryshnikov's act to do. And again, he has to, there's also, I think, something that's probably, that's worth noting here is that I don't know whether Hines was fluent in Russian or not. He has to speak a fair degree of Russian throughout this movie. There, and again...
Yeah, and it doesn't sound obtrusive when he does.
Yeah, and I mean, this film, it doesn't completely avoid the Hollywood thing of characters switching between speaking English and Russian during various scenes. But for the most part...
Yeah, and it certainly doesn't do anything as clever as in Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, but, you know, for the most part, when you have scenes such as, you know, Raymond and his wife by themselves, Yeah, they're speaking Russian. They're not, you know, going another way. When they're doing the production of Porgy and Bess, all the singing is in English, but the just general dialogue, it's in Russian. And yeah, so you have an actor having to perform in what I'm assuming is a language he was probably wasn't overly familiar with prior to this, dancing on top of it, and, you know, then having to sing on top of that. That's, I mean, this is a difficult combination for anybody to play. And again, I mean, what failings there are in the film, I honestly think are less to do with Hines' performance and more to do with Hackford's direction. I suspect that in many cases, the overplaying of the infighting between him and Rodchenko has more to do with how Hackford's like, hey, you gotta play it a little bit more broadly. Likewise, in the final scene when there is the prisoner exchange, I get the feeling that Hines was probably asked to be a little more heightened than he is otherwise in the film. I mean, it's a small, noticeable change in his performance at that point, but it's not terrible, it's just noticeably not as affecting as the rest of the stuff in the film. And again, I've seen Hines in other works. He is, again, a very charming and natural performer in those things, which is why I'm probably giving him a bit more benefit of the doubt in terms of what his limitations may or may not be. But yeah, Hines, if more so even than Baryshnikov, he's the reason to see this movie. And even if it is just to see that monologue scene, because hot damn, that really needs to be seen to be believed, so.
Well, yeah. I mean, that scene alone, I think, deserves its own hit. But, yeah, because, like, it's a very emotive monologue. And, like, there's some very real anger, and it's drawing on a lot of real issues. And it's exploring the idea of what freedom in America means from a very different angle than you would assume this film would take. It's pretty bold, and yeah, like, it succeeds by virtue of his delivery. I'm not as familiar with Hines' film work, but I will say that, like, watching it this time, even the scenes where, like, the performance kind of veers off course, that has this weird effect of just making Raymond even more charming, in the sense of, like, there is that vulnerability and that frailty to him, and that sense of, like, well, you're doing your absolute best, and even though it's not quite there, like, there's something earnest in the attempt. And, like, I don't know, it's weird because I don't want to imply that, like, well, even a garbage movie can be tolerated if everyone's just given their 110%. I think with Hines, though, like, there is just something vulnerable about him that's hard to dislike. And I just feel so bad for him all throughout the film.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing. I mean, Raymond is a very sympathetic character. And I mean, yeah, it does take a, you know, the film isn't quite as uplifting as I think it wants to be at the end when you realize that, yeah, he's still screwed from this moment forward going on in the rest of this, when he gets back to America. Yeah.
But what this film needed was the Graduate ending, when they get in the car and then they just start driving and that's like the smile face and, yep, now what?
Yeah, John Glover just turns around. You realize you're still going to prison, right? I mean, it's American prison, but it's a prison still. So.
Here, put on this orange jumpsuit. Well, speaking of convictable offenses, shall we talk about where the film goes astray?
Absolutely. So I think you're up to bat here. So what would be the first pit you'd like to highlight?
Oh, there's a lot to pick from. In the interest of wrapping things up, I'm going to focus pretty much on all the minor ones. Okay, so two fashion faux pas. Almost every scene, Raymond is wearing a Cosby sweater, which is very distracting. And it also dawned on me right before the end. Baryshnikov is a handsome man. He's being sold as the star of this film. He spends about 95% of the film with a massive bandage on his forehead. Why?
True.
Like, I imagine he got injured on set and they have to work around it or something. Because narratively, he's been diagnosed with a hematoma, but he spends literally the rest of the film with this enormous bandage covering the better part of his forehead. And it, again, Victor Mature's hair, Clint Eastwood's pompadour, and, like, little things like that. Once you fixate on it, it becomes very distracting.
I can't say I had the same reaction as you to this, but fair enough.
I'm gonna save my realness, because I have a feeling you're gonna get there first. But yes, what about you, David?
For the second week in a row, a completely unnecessary and needless. It's never needed, but I mean, why does anybody have to use the N-word? We get it. Chaco's the bad guy. You didn't have to suddenly have him drop that in order to indicate that he is a villain in this movie here. Like, seriously, yeah, folks.
It's just so weird because, like, there are many ways that films over time have illustrated the evils of the Soviet Union. This is the only one that I think concretizes, like, the inherent villainy of Mother Russia by using the N-word. And I'm like, whoa, that came out of nowhere. Especially because in the context of the scene, like, the implication of what he's saying is well clear to anybody watching the film. So it's an unnecessary exclamation point that does not need to be made. It's very jarring.
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, that really has no place to do in this movie. But it's there, and yeah, we have to acknowledge that it's there. I'm kind of hoping that Enemy next week doesn't have the... I just tipped her hand, didn't I? I guess I should just blank that when I do the editing on this.
Tell people to keep listening for another 2.5 minutes.
There we go. Anyways, yeah, that's my first hit. What about you, Andrew? What is your second hit here?
Second hit?
Okay, I'm not recovering here.
We have Cosby sweaters, forehead bandages, and the N-word. I think if you're making a film that is over 2 hours, you need a better sense of what it's actually supposed to be about. This film gets a bit shaggy and a bit long in the tooth, and as a result, as we outlined earlier, like, it kind of sputters across the finish line and runs out of steam well before it actually concludes. So, yeah, I think, honestly, had they tightened it up and just made a shorter film, it would give more of a sense of natural structure to it. So, I mean, I can imagine that if you're trying to do as much as this film is doing, it's hard to figure out a nice linear structure for it. But I think there's a bit of bloat, and I think that really is where most of the issues we've pointed to come from. So yeah, it's more of a shame because, like, especially with our introductions to both characters, it's remarkably efficient and economical in its storytelling. It just, once again, it seems to forget what it did in the first half of the film to its detriment.
Yeah, no, it's hard to disagree with that. But to wrap this one up, I guess the last pit I'm going to offer here, and it's not even quite a full-on pit, but I think it bears mentioning, which is...
Okay, I listed Cosby sweaters, so everything is fair game.
Well, I was going to say Michel Colombier, the composer of this film. Again, the soundtrack as compiled by Phil Ramone, I think, is really good for this movie. Maybe not quite Flashdance amazing, but still good. The actual score, though, it's not that it's terrible. It's just, it's very on the nose and bombastic. I think the worst scene is the prior mentioned Statue of Lenin moment when they move to Leningrad. But it's not like the rest of the score is any more subtle than that going forward. I mean, it's not, it doesn't take you out of the movie, but you get the sense that maybe something a little more nuanced wouldn't have gone amiss in this film, and certainly would have probably blended better with the soundtrack, or with the songs on the soundtrack better there. Although, again, how on earth did Lionel Richie win for Best Oscar in this movie? I still don't understand what it was about. I mean, like, you would assume your best original song has to somehow also connect to how it's utilized in the movie at some point, and... Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everybody left being very happy listening to Lionel Richie, but seriously.
I think the bigger question is, why wasn't Lionel Richie nominated for Best Actor for his role in the video for Hello?
So, Andrew, where are you taking us next week?
All right. Next week, we're going to go to equally weird, but far, far shorter territory. And actually, I am very excited about this one. It has been a film I have really, really admired ever since I first saw it, and I'm very curious to hear what my good pal Dave thinks about it. We are going to be following Isabella Rossellini to Denis Villeneuve's Enemy from 2013, a film where spiders, shoes, and doppelgangers all come together in a little city called Toronto. It is, again, in that category of films that you're never going to see anything quite like, and I am very, very excited about tearing it to pieces with you.
Okay, then. So, make sure you stay tuned for that next week, folks. But until then, Andrew, let's just say, you know, there were some hardcore White Knight fans who wanted us to let us know about the nuances and subtleties we missed, and why Lionel Richie's song deserved that Oscar win. Where could they contact you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. You can find me at Filmstripper. And you, Dave.
Hey, if you wish to contact me, you can find me at 24Panels on Twitter. But let's just say you want to leave a more formal review of the program. Where could they do that, Andrew, if they so wished?
The best place to do it is on iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use. Leaving 5-star reviews are the best way to get increased visibility to our show. But ultimately, the most valuable part is your feedback. Every single week, me and David try to make the kind of show that you good people at home want to listen to. And, well, we can't really fix anything if we don't know what's broken.
Yeah. So, until next time...
We take criticism better than the Soviet Union, anyway.
Well, most people do. But on that note, well, I guess maybe contemporary Russia doesn't take it that well either. But that might have to do with what's more that's later. At any rate...
Well, we just got too real.
Yeah. So, but until next time, Andrew, what parting words would you like to leave our listeners with?
Probably gonna go with my old standby, David. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless a plane crash in Soviet territory does it first. Bye!